And Leroy?
Hey, how's it going?
And Leroy?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Right. Well, a problem with a technical difficulty there. This is Andrew Herod. We just listened to Yankee Doodle Dandy introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your host, Andrew Herod. And we're in a revolutionary state of mind here on July 2nd, going into an Independence Day weekend for the 4th of July. And for that reason, we want to talk with Dan Leroy, the recent author of a book called Liberty's Lions, the Catholic Revolutionaries Who Made America. A very interesting book, which he's just published with Sophia Institute Press, where he looks at the various Catholic individuals who had leading roles in winning the fight for American liberty in 1776. Well, welcome to the show, Dan Leroy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate the chance to talk about the book, especially on the eve of Independence Day weekend.
Well, starting out, describe your background and what caused you to write this book.
Well, I was born Catholic, returned to the faith as an adult, and the two things that really caused the writing of the book are, first of all, I was lucky enough to grow up in a household where history was prized, and my mother in particular is a great historian, a great genealogist, and she always made a point of making sure that my brother and I both knew that it's important to know where you come from. It's important to know how one historical event leads to another. The second place that it came about is in the Perpetual Adoration Chapel of my home parish of St. Monica in the Diocese of Pittsburgh. And we're lucky to have a chapel like this where you can spend time and reflect with the Eucharist. And it was in the chapel a couple of years ago. I was reading a column by Professor Anthony Esselin, who wrote about one of these Catholic revolutionaries, Casimir Pulaski, the father of the American cavalry. And at the end of the column, Professor Esselin mentioned that there were some other Catholic revolutionaries who were pretty instrumental in the fight for independence. So I went looking for the book that would tell me more about them, and I couldn't find it. So instead, I set out to write it myself, and that's where Liberty's Lions ultimately came from.
Well, starting out and discussing this book as you analyze, what was discuss the role of Catholics in America, in colonial America at the time of the Revolution?
Well, the best way to describe that role is that they were, for all intents and purposes, second-class citizens everywhere. And they were second-class citizens even if they had as much money as a Catholic founder like Charles Carroll of Carrollton, who was one of the wealthiest men in America. Catholics at the time throughout the colonies couldn't vote, couldn't hold public office. If they wanted their children to be educated in the Catholic faith, then they had to send them abroad, and often they had to be taxed an exorbitant amount to pay for the privilege of sending their children abroad to get this Catholic education. In the whole British Empire, in colonial America, there are only two places where you can attend a public mass, and those are in Philadelphia, Old St. Joseph's Church, and right down the street, Old St. Mary's. So for Catholics, by and large, they are served by a set of circuit-riding priests. Many of them are Jesuits, and these priests are carrying the faith throughout the colonies to people who might get to attend a mass once a year, if they're lucky. And often these masses are conducted in secret. But the other thing that happens as a result of these circuit-riding priests is that many of these circuit riders are also patriots, people like Father John Carroll, who's mentioned in the book, and also mentioned are a couple of other Jesuits, Father Ferdinand Farmer, and out west, Father Pierre Gibault. And these Catholic priests are not just taking the faith to people that they serve in their circuit rides, they're also taking with them this idea of independence. And that's one of the ways that this idea is passed on to colonial Catholics, and it's one way that this idea gains popularity. You know, at a time, to go back to the beginning of the answer here, to go back to this idea that Catholics really didn't have a strong reason in a lot of ways to join the fight for independence, because some of the persecution that they suffered is at the hands of their fellow colonial citizens. So the fact that they did, in fact, and all the evidence suggests that they did, in fact, sign on in pretty large numbers, that's due to, I think, Catholic leadership, and it's due in particular amounts to the example of these circuit riders that we just mentioned.
Yeah, you discuss, it's very interesting, in the book you discuss this repression that Catholics lived under, even, for example, in Maryland, which started out as this colony for Catholics, founded by Lord Baltimore. The English king gave Lord Baltimore a charter to found a colony in Maryland, hence the name of Baltimore City in Maryland. But it was founded by Catholics, but ultimately Protestants took over the overhand, became the majority in Maryland, and such by 1700, I believe it was, or 1704, you had legislation in Maryland that denied Catholics the right to vote and the right to run for office. And also you mentioned the Father Ferdinand Farmer, a person you write about in the book. This person, he went by the name of Ferdinand Farmer in the United States. He was actually a German-born individual, had another German name, Andreas Steinmeier, as you indicate in the book. But he would go around on the circuit riding to parishes in America. For example, he would go into New York State, and there was actually in 1700 there had been passed a law against popery, if I recall the title, against Jewish rabbis and popery, where it's actually a death penalty for harboring a Catholic priest or a Jewish rabbi. So he had to really disguise himself and go around to offer religious services in New York City at the time. One thing I find interesting talking about this, discuss with us the Quebec Act of 1774 in the British Empire from under King George III for the Quebec province in Canada and how that influenced the American Revolution.
Well, the Quebec Act, on one hand, is a really brilliant piece of statesmanship on the part of the British. What they do is extend religious liberty to all Catholics, and there are a lot of them, French Catholics, in Canada. And it's a very cynical ploy on one hand, because they're doing this precisely because they know the effect that it's probably going to have on the colonies, and they were proven right in that respect. But the other part of it that makes it a pretty smart piece of statesmanship is that the Quebec Act and basically allowing French Catholics to continue living as they have lived and worshiping as they've worshiped, it's something that we see later on throughout the British Empire, this idea that when the colonizers are outnumbered, and they were outnumbered usually by the native population, it's probably a smart idea to let the native population live as they have lived to as much an extent as it's possible. So we see this policy followed, for example, in India later on. But the other thing that the Quebec Act does, as we were just saying, is it sort of inflames the passions of a lot of the colonial leaders who see it as kind of a backhanded way to institute popery throughout the colonies, because they're worried that what happens among French Canadians is going to find its way into the colonies eventually. And you have founders like Alexander Hamilton, who was certainly not a great fan of Catholicism, who are warning that, hey, now that the Quebec Act has been passed, we're going to see these foreign armies of Catholics be imported into the colonies, and they're going to be serving the Pope, and they're going to take over. You know, coming from a guy who was an immigrant himself, it's a little bit rich to read some of these things that Hamilton wrote. But what happens ultimately is that the Suffolk results are drafted, and these are a set of responses to the Quebec Act, and that really complicates relations between the colonies and Canada, because again, these Canadian citizens, most of them are French Catholics. They've just been given religious liberty by the British. That religious liberty has been condemned by the colonists, and then within a year or two, once war really is inevitable, the Continental Congress realizes, like, oh, wow, we'd better probably mend our fences with our Canadian neighbors. And so they send a delegation to Canada to try to if nothing else, convince the Canadians to stay neutral in the conflict. And if they're lucky, maybe they can convince the Canadians to take the side of the Patriot cause. That mission trip was a failure in the short term, but it would have some pretty significant effects for Catholics in the long term, because on this trip, Father John Carroll and Benjamin Franklin strike up a kind of unlikely friendship. And this friendship endures, and years later, after the Revolution, when it comes time for Catholics to select their first bishop, Benjamin Franklin plays a pretty important role in advancing the cause of Father John Carroll to become that first Catholic bishop, which he does in fact become, and later he becomes the first Catholic archbishop. But it's all based on this set of very small kindnesses that Father Carroll enacted for Benjamin Franklin on this very difficult and, again, in the short term, unsuccessful mission trip that happened way back in 1776.
Yeah, it's an interesting story with Quebec, that this Quebec Act granting religious liberty to Quebec and the French Canadians there, who had just come under British rule at the end of the 7 Years' War, as we call it here in North America, the French and Indian War, in 1763, after the British won the Battle of the Plains of Abraham at the city of Quebec. You had then these French Canadians under British rule. And I find it interesting in the book, there's an interesting contrast that you talk about. We had this Quebec Act, and Americans denounced it as among the 5 intolerable acts, along with the other acts that the British Empire, British government had imposed of, closing Boston Harbor after the 1773 Tea Party Institute, the destruction of the importation of tea on a British ship being dumped into the harbor in order to avoid paying the British tax on tea, the no taxation without representation. So on the one hand, Americans with this anti-Catholic animus, they really alienated all these potential allies of French Canadians in Quebec. But on the other hand, later in the book, you discuss, as you mentioned, this Father Pierre Guibault, another one of these French missionaries, circuit riders, in this case out in what was then called the West, or what was later called the Northwest Province in the territory of Illinois. That he later played an instrumental role when George Rogers Clark led his expedition in 1778 and later in 1779 into the Northwest Territory on behalf of the Virginia government to try to take this territory from the British. And there, because of George Rogers Clark's assurances and friendship with Pierre Guibault, Father Guibault, and the French settlers there who had also come under British rule in 1763, that there he really won over that population and was able to rather easily conquer that territory from the British. So that's an interesting contrast between how Americans dealt with Catholics in Quebec and Catholics, French Catholics out in the Northwest Territory.
I think one of the things that really I didn't realize until writing this book, but I think it's one of the things that gets really short shrift historically is, we tend to think of the Revolutionary War as something that really only exists within these 13 colonies with which we're familiar. And obviously a lot of it does take place there. And within those 13 colonies, Catholics are a very, very small minority, something like 24,000 to 30,000 people. So we're talking less than 2% of the total colonial population at the time. And it's for that reason, I think, that people will say and have said, Catholics, how important could they have been to the revolutionary cause? But the thing that doesn't factor in is, if you look at the map and you look to the north, and we were just talking about the French Canadian, you look to the west, as you mentioned, all along the Mississippi River and even into the Louisiana Territory. You look to the south, Spanish Florida. The colonies are surrounded by Catholic populations. And not only are they surrounded by these populations in a lot of cases play a very, very big part in what happens back east. You just mentioned the role that Pierre Guibault played in winning over this string of forts all along the western frontier. He was able to do it because people knew him. They trusted him. In some cases, these forts are taken without a shot being fired, really on the strength of his character. But without the Western frontier being won over as easily as was the case, we wouldn't see some of the things that we are more familiar with back east. A good example of that is what happens with the Spanish patriot, Bernardo Galvez, who helps win over a very important section of Spanish Florida that's contested by the British. And the battle that happens there is really instrumental in setting the stage for Yorktown. We can't get to these familiar battles if we don't have some of these battles that are much lesser known that take place, again, along these Catholic borders of the 13 colonies. So I won't try to make the case that Catholics were instrumental at this time. Part of that means we have to pull back a little bit and look at the entire map and not just focus on the 13 colonies, and not even the 13 colonies. Really, our view of things is limited to a handful of colonies and the very significant battles that were fought there. But these battles don't get won for the Patriots without these contributions of Catholics all along the borders of colonial America.
Yes, yeah, interesting chapter you have there on Bernardo, Benedito Galvez, after whom Galveston, mm-hmm. Texas is now named, who was in March and May of 1781, took Pensacola, which was then occupied by the British in Florida, and that then robbed the British of a key base in the Gulf of Mexico in the Caribbean area. And that then weakened British naval power and allowed for the French to send their navy to Yorktown under the French Admiral de Grasse and to hold off the British fleet there and thereby trap the British army under Lord Cornwallis, which led to this great defeat of the British that then broke the resolve of the British in the American Revolution. And you talk about how Galvez was the governor of Louisiana, which the French had given to the Spanish in 1762 and sold off before they briefly acquired it after the American Revolution, and then, of course, sold it to the Americans under President Thomas Jefferson. So, yeah, that's a very interesting story that all these people aiding America from abroad or from these Catholic countries. And you also, for example, talk about the role of France and others like the Polish volunteers, Kazimierz Pulaski and Thaddeus Kosciuszko. For example, Kazimierz Pulaski, is often considered the father of American cavalry, and Kosciuszko, on the other hand, was a key engineer who played a role in the battle of another key American victory at Saratoga in 1777. Talk about these two Polish volunteers a bit and how the role of their Catholic faith.
Absolutely. You know, the Polish contributions in particular are kind of piquant because both the guys that you mentioned, Kazimierz Pulaski and Kosciuszko, both great revolutionaries here in America, but also abroad, back home in Poland. And they both were very instrumental in the American independence that was ultimately won. Pulaski starts his career at the Battle of the Brandywine in 1777. He puts together this ragtag group of cavalrymen that helps cover the retreat of General Washington. He's moments away from being captured because he's been outflanked by Cornwallis at the Battle of the Brandywine, and he's about to be captured. Pulaski rides in and helps cover Washington's retreat successfully, and certainly had Washington been captured, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. Kosciuszko, like you mentioned, a brilliant engineer. He's very instrumental in the building of West Point, which is the citadel along the Hudson River that George Washington had always wanted. Then he moves to the Southern Theater, and among other things he does is he constructs this series of flatboats, which allow the Patriots to stay one step ahead of the British. And once again, Cornwallis is important in this picture. The Patriots don't really win any battles in the South, but it's a war of attrition. And because they're able to stay one step ahead of the Redcoats, they are able to wear out Cornwallis's army, which eventually, as we know, ends up kind of penned in at Yorktown. So Kosciuszko and Pulaski, both instrumental in American independence, but sadly for both of them, they weren't able to do the same thing in their home country. They were not able to save it from the partitioning that happened at the hands of Russia and Prussia and Austria. Pulaski is part of the revolutionary movement in Poland before the American Revolution, and then Kosciuszko comes back because he does, unlike Pulaski, survive the American Revolution. He comes back to his home country following the War for Independence, and he tries once again to save Poland from being partitioned, and he fights heroically, and he fights against almost impossible odds. But because he's such a military genius, he's able for a time to hold off the Russian army. Ultimately, though, he's not successful. He's captured, taken to St. Petersburg, and is imprisoned. And he's only released when Catherine the Great dies and her son takes over, Tsar Paul. So both of these guys were able to do in America what they were not able to do in their home country. We could extend that even to the French revolutionaries that we're more familiar with, the guys like Lafayette and Rochambeau and others who fought in America and then tried to take this revolution back home to France. But, you know, it didn't work out the way that it did. And I think the big takeaway there is something that I think a lot of people take for granted. The American Revolution is not like any other revolution historically. Revolutions are not supposed to end up the way this one did. The much more common story is that it ends up the way that it did in France or in Poland or in other places. Either the revolution is crushed or the revolution devours all of its own revolutionaries. What happened in America, it's a pretty singular story. And as we come up on July 4th, it's something that I really think is important for everybody to remember, Catholic and non-Catholic alike.
Yeah, that's it. And you talk about that, particularly in the case of the individuals from France, key individuals there, Marquis de Lafayette. Of course, we remember this general, who came over, and you mentioned some interesting historical details. I guess I hadn't personally realized that the British had killed his father in 1759 at the Battle of Minden in what is now Germany in Central Europe. Lafayette came from this military family. You note that he had ancestors who had military careers going back to Joan of Arc, but his father had been killed at the Battle of Minden when Lafayette himself was only like 2 years old. So Lafayette had this real personal grudge against the British and a real desire, along with other French, to fight against the British. And then as well, the Comte de Rochambeau, the commander-in-chief of this French expeditionary force that was sent to America after France recognized the American colonies, the United States, and joined this alliance in 1778, on February 6, 1778, and they sent this, as you know, this expedition particulière under the Comte de Rochambeau to help fight alongside the Americans against the British, and first landed in Newport, Rhode Island. I find it interesting, particularly in the case of Rochambeau, that you note that he was actually trained to be a priest, but then his elder brother died, and his family as well had a military tradition, and so that the eldest son in the family had to go on into the military, and so he was trained to be a Jesuit priest, but then was told, hey, look, you've got to carry on the family line now in the military, and then became this famous general. So there you have a very particularly devout faith in an individual as something perhaps Americans aren't quite aware of, that this key ally at the Battle of Yorktown had such a devout Catholic faith.
I think the other thing about Rochambeau that is interesting is that, you know, he comes over, as you say, as part of this expeditionary force, and he has to, first of all, overcome a lot of prejudice against the French. Because the British have been telling people for years and years and years how horrible the French were. And, of course, the Seven Years' War is something that was still fresh in a lot of people's memories at this time. So he has to overcome quite a bit of anti-French sentiment. He's able to do it successfully. And, in fact, he is able to command this expeditionary force so successfully that there's a quote in there somewhere that he said very proudly as they did their march all through, all down the eastern seaboard, not a cabbage was disturbed. You know, people were used to the British forces certainly coming in, taking whatever they wanted. That also happened on the colonial side as well. The troops under Russian Bo were very, very well disciplined, and people kind of reevaluated these prejudices they had against the French thanks to his leadership. And the other thing that he did that I think a lot of people maybe don't realize is New York was such a symbolic place, even then, for colonial leaders. And in the late winter of 1780 and the early spring of 1781, George Washington has a choice. He can try to retake New York because it looks like it's possible to do this, or he can go south and try to engage with Cornwallis. And Washington, he really wants New York back. And so do a lot of the other colonial leaders. Alexander Hamilton very badly wants to retake New York. It's a pride thing for a lot of these guys. Russian Bo is the guy who ends up talking them out of it and talking George Washington personally out of this idea, saying, look, we need to go south. We need to meet up with this force that is coming from the Caribbean. We can get them to join us. We can meet at Yorktown. We can strike a very decisive blow there. And also, we're not going to be able to do the same thing in New York. We are not going to have the same sort of success. That's really the last critical decision that happens in the Revolution. Had the colonial forces gone to New York, as many people wanted to do, history probably turns out much differently. It's Russian Bo who sees the writing on the wall and sees that the Southern strategy is the better one to pursue.
Yeah, another key contribution there in this critical final Southern campaign, as it's called, of the American Revolution, where the British, after defeats in the north, like Saratoga, in attempts to divide the hotbed of the Revolution, New England, from the rest of the colonies along the Hudson River, you then had the British turn to the South, the American South, where they thought they could rely more upon American loyalist support. And as you say, you know, Kosciuszko had this key role in this American campaign where the American army was always trying to avoid destruction, stay in being, and avoid a climactic battle with the British. And, for example, getting across the Dan River with these boats that Kosciuszko helped assemble on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1781. But here, Rochambeau as well, with the French army, convinced the Americans that don't attack the British in New York City, where they had such prepared defenses. They had really built up their defenses and would have been a really hard campaign, but instead turn south, where the Marquis Lafayette was already in command of a force that was harrying the British operating in Virginia, where eventually Lord Cornwallis based his army at Yorktown on the James River Peninsula there. And the idea then of Rochambeau was, you know, combine there all of our naval and land forces and try to force that army to surrender. And indeed, at Yorktown, as you know, there was only about 1,000 casualties to force the surrender of Lord Cornwallis' British army on October 19th, 1781, this key victory effectively ending the American Revolution, breaking the British resolve to continue fighting. And also it's notable that at Yorktown, most of the soldiers were actually French. The French forces outnumbered the American forces at Yorktown, to say nothing of the French fleet that came up from the Caribbean under de Grasse that warded off the British fleet under Thomas Graves at what's called the Battle of the Capes on September 5th, 1781. So, again, a key contribution from these foreigners, many of whom, as you've noted in your book, some 70% of all these allies, it's estimated, were Catholics, the Spanish, the French, these volunteers, Pulaski and Thaddeus Kosciuszko. So I guess in this time of American independence, we should remember our alliances and our allies.
You know, that's a thing that's kind of gotten underplayed really since the time of the Revolution, the fact that we did have significant foreign contributions. And even Alexander Hamilton, I think, has the best quote about this. In 1780, when things are really looking bleak for the colonial forces, Hamilton writes, you know, if we're to be saved, France and Spain will have to save us. And for a guy who, as mentioned earlier, was not a great friend of Catholics, to make an admission like that, you know, it took some guts. And it turns out that Hamilton was right. Now, the flip side of that coin is that some of these Frenchmen, some of the contributors that are mentioned in Liberty's Lions, like Beaumarchais, the playwright who is instrumental in getting, in today's dollars, $3 billion in military aid and supplies to the colonists. You know, there were a lot of people who put up their own money, who did not, let's just say it this way, did not receive full repayment for their services rendered. So when we talk today about the fact that the foreign contributions to the American Revolution are underrated, you got to remember that goes back almost to the beginnings of the Republic. There were folks, you mentioned one of them, Father Pierre Gibault, who also put up some of his own money and did not get repayment. So a lot of people put up a lot of their own funds. They weren't always repaid. Why did they do this? You know, they did it because they believed that strongly in this cause, strongly enough to put up, in a lot of cases, their own money and substantial amounts of their own money and resources to aid this patriot cause.
Yeah, and that's another key contribution. I mean, you talk in the book about not just, you know, actual fighters and individuals, but the aid from this Pierre Augustin, if I remember his name, full name, his last name is Beaumarchais, de Beaumarchais, mm-hmm. Who was instrumental operating for the French government in running this dummy corporation called Roderick Hortelez and Company, and shipping all of this aid even to the United States, to the colonies, the rebellious colonies, even before France officially recognized the United States after the Saratoga victory in the Treaty of Alliance coming in February 6, 1778. And indeed, during the Saratoga campaign, the fighting in New York, the rebels themselves, the colonists, spoke of the Beaumarchais arms that were so critical in keeping American forces in the field. I believe one figure you cite was something like, in today's dollars, it would be like about, it's an estimated $3 billion in aid that France covertly sent to the American rebels to keep them in the field, all these cannon and guns and powder, as well as then there was aid from Spain through, for example, this funneled, administered by this Irish individual living in then Spanish Louisiana, Pollock, if I recall his name.
Or, Pollock.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, this key aid is really keeping the American Revolution alive. I mean, that's something you would think of today, like the United States government funding the Afghan Mujahideen in the 1980s against the Soviet Union.
Well, you know, one of the nice little pieces of historical circularity there is you mentioned the victory at Saratoga, and Saratoga is the colonial victory that the French have been waiting for. This is the thing that will allow them finally to enter the war on the side of the Patriots. But as you also mentioned, that victory at Saratoga would have been impossible without these arms, which were supplied by Beaumarchais with the help of the French government. So the French have been involved, and so have the Spanish, since the earliest stages of the war, covertly. But thanks to those covert contributions, the Patriots are then able to win this significant victory at Saratoga, which then allows the French to overtly enter the war. So it's kind of a big circle, if you will, with these French contributions covertly leading to the public entry of France into the war.
And I find they're interesting. There's some indications in your book, a few references you make, that France had actually been sort of engaged in investigations, sort of intelligence operations,
even say back in the 1760s or looking for information on what was the feeling of the colonists towards the British Empire. This is, you know, we're talking about a France that was angry after its defeat in the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War here in the United States, where in the 1763 Treaty of Paris, if I recall correctly, another treaty, if not, they lost New France in Canada and Quebec, and so they were really looking for a revenge here. What sort of things did the French do before the outbreak of actual fighting in North America or what were they looking for, and what indications did the French receive that Americans were really getting restive under a British rule?
That is it's a great question. And as you say, after the French and Indian War and after this peace that is imposed on the French, you know, they didn't just go gently into that good night. They really were planning almost from the moment of defeat about how they could regain some of what had been lost. And as you say, they had done some kind of covert man-on-the-ground kind of surveillance. Baron de Kalb, who was a French agent who was working in the colonies in the 1760s, reported back, I think it's in 1768, and says to the French government that he does think that eventually the colonies are going to want to declare their independence, but he doesn't think it's going to happen until the population in the colonies exceeds that of Great Britain. So he was right on the one conjecture and not exactly right on the second part of that. The French also, under the foreign minister Vergennes, are always looking for ways that they might be able to advance their cause on the continent as well. And that takes the form of a lot of plans, none of which really come to fruition at this time, but at least in the planning stages, there are several ideas about invasions of England itself, particularly along these coastlines, which are not always well defended. There's a pretty famous example of this, or maybe a better known example than some of the others, that Lafayette and Benjamin Franklin kind of team up during the Revolutionary War to talk about the idea of invading England. And the planning, I guess, gets pretty far. Weather ultimately means that they cannot go through with this plan. But the French, again, under Vergennes in particular, who was a guy who was very, very smart and very, very determined to recapture a lot of this ground that had been lost during the French and Indian War, the French were always planning. They were always looking for their angle. That's why it was a pretty attractive idea to start up something or to help fund something like this dummy corporation that Beaumarchais was involved with, which you mentioned just a little bit earlier. They want to be involved. They are involved. They have spies. They have plans. But they cannot act until things have advanced pretty far. As we know, that moment was the Patriot victory at Saratoga.
Yeah, and then, now looking at the French, this is another interesting story. You talk about the French foreign minister, Vergennes, if I'm saying his name right. He actually had ideas now. So the French, you know, the French, they have their own motives for fighting the British. You know, they want revenge. They want payback. They want to move forward with their own interests against the British. But they're actually thinking of trying to maybe set up some sort of dictatorship in the United States. So they're not really interested in having a free American republic here. So on the other hand, you know, Americans have to think, well, what are the French interests? And as you indicated before, you compare the American and the French revolution, and this then affects these two individuals, Rochambeau and Marquis de Lafayette, who in the French Revolution, when it breaks out in 1789, they end up being, you know, both of them almost facing death under this French Revolution that turns into tyranny. As you indicated, you know, revolutions are often turn out like the American Revolution leading to liberty. Discuss what went wrong with the French Revolution and why were, say, Rochambeau and the Marquis de Lafayette disappointed in their hopes for having a better France like America?
Well, the root causes of both of these revolutions are pretty different. one thing that we could say in the case of the French Revolution, which I think a lot of people are aware of, is a lot of this is a rebellion in part, not just against the monarchy, but also against the clergy. And certainly in the monarchy and in the clergy leading up to the French Revolution, there were certainly abuses. And the fact that, for example, the clergy paid no taxes at a time when revenue was in very short supply. The French had crushing war debts, both from the French and Indian War and then also from their role in the American Revolution. Then there's a series of weather-related mishaps. Crops fail. There's drought. There are floods. It's sort of like a year-long meteorological calamity. All of this kind of builds up. And the fact that, you know, they need money and they can't get money easily from the elite, and the clergy are among the elite, that is part of this backlash that happens. But say all that to say that some of the abuses against the clergy during the French Revolution, we don't see anything like this in the American Revolution. Certainly nothing like the seizing of church property, the killing of priests and nuns. The French Revolution, in short, is a completely secular revolution. And that goes as far as essentially not just taking church property, but also enshrining reason as sort of the thing that takes the place of faith. I would make the argument that that's one of the key differences. That's what allows the French Revolution to kind of spiral very quickly out of control, that it is purely secular, that there is no role for any sort of faith, to the point that priests who are allowed to practice are called juring priests. In other words, they are approved by the government. And if you do not submit to the dictates of government, then you are not allowed to practice. You're a non-juring priest. This really creates a situation where there is no underpinning for people of faith. And that's a pretty important difference between the French Revolution and our revolution. Certainly our revolution has the idea of religious liberty underpinning it. In France, it's kind of the opposite. There is no liberty for any sort of religion other than a very secular religion of reason. And, you know, we see where that reason ended up. It ended up with people like Rochambeau, who was a hero in France and in the American Revolution. He's on death row. He's only spared because the revolutionaries end up eating their own so completely that there's nobody left to behead him by the time his number is up. Lafayette ends up in prison. He probably would have been killed had he been in France, but he's imprisoned in what's now Austria. So both of these guys, and there are others who were French heroes of the American Revolution who came back home and were very bitterly disappointed at what they found in the French Revolution. Huge, significant differences. And Lafayette, sadly, I think, is a guy who really saw this far too late. And maybe later in his life, he recognized this. When he comes to America on his farewell tour in 1824 and 1825, people line up to see this guy because he is still lionized as the hero of the American Revolution. Whereas back in France, it took a long time for his reputation to be rehabilitated. And it never reached I think you'd probably make the argument even today, Lafayette's reputation is not what it was when he was at his peak. So long-winded answer to the question. I don't know if I really got to all of it because it's such a complicated subject. But the thing that's frustrating is when people look at the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and they believe, I think very wrongly, that they're kind of the same. Not so much, not really.
yeah, and particularly from a Catholic perspective, you know, this difference in what is developed in the French doctrine of laïcité, you know, this attempt to have a really secular state, just, you know, keeping your religion out of it. You know, you had in the French Revolution, you had what's often considered to be a genocide against the revolting Catholics of the Vendée region of France. You know, people just being put on boats, and the boats in a river, and the boats would be sunk, and masses of people would be drowned all at once. And speaking of Lafayette, you note in the book that his wife, Adrienne, if I'm saying her name correctly, Adrienne, that her mother, grandmother, and sister, if I recall correctly, were all executed at once in this mass execution. They all one day, along with a bunch of others, were sent to the guillotine and were able to receive a final absolution from a priest who had hidden himself among them and was able to, in disguise, offer them absolution amidst the crowd there. So, yeah, a really fundamentally different religion here. And as you note, there's this fundamental difference that America's revolution really was fundamentally faith-based among people who believed in Christianity, in the Bible, and had a sense of moral duty. In particular, you note Charles Carroll, going back to Maryland again, from Maryland, was the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence, and you argue that he was one of the first people in America to really think about the necessity for America to break off and ultimately become independent. Discuss him a little bit. This cousin, indeed, of John Carroll, who became the first Archbishop of the United States after the Revolution.
Well, Charles Carroll of Carrollton is a very intelligent man. He's a very wealthy man. As you note, he's the only Catholic signer of the Declaration of Independence. But one of the things that I think he doesn't get enough credit for is that he, along with a lot of his other fellow Maryland Catholics, realizes pretty early on a fundamental truth. You know, we talk about the American Revolution often, and we talk about it in terms of, you know, taxation without representation. That's generally the way that it's taught. And there's certainly some truth to that. But taxation without representation carries with it this implication, which is that if we get representation, then taxation is okay. That's fine. And we can preserve our colonial relationship. As a Catholic, Charles Carroll realized, and again, this is something that in Maryland history goes back the better part of 100 years, Maryland Catholics understand that by virtue of their colonial charter, which guarantees them religious liberty, even if that is sometimes only theoretical, by virtue of this charter and by virtue of their history, which sometimes does include moments of genuine religious tolerance, the Religious Toleration Act of 1649 is kind of a high water mark for religious toleration in the 17th century in the British Empire. By virtue of the charter, by virtue of their history, they've become something different from England. They are no longer just England transplanted across the Atlantic. They have their own customs. They have their own history. And there is nothing anymore that binds them to England as a result. And it's this idea, which is transplanted into a more secular context, that really becomes the thing that animates the Declaration of Independence. You know, for in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for when people to dissolve the bonds. That's really the realization that Maryland Catholics had something like 50 or 60 years before the Revolution. And Charles Carroll of Carrollton, among his fellow founders, is one of the very, very early, maybe even the first of them to recognize this fact that it's too late. You know, you have some founders like Thomas Jefferson who even after Lexington and Concord are still trying to figure out, hey, how can we repair this relationship? Now, this is bad, but there's still something that we can do perhaps to fix it. Charles Carroll of Carrollton saw 10 years earlier, it just wasn't going to happen, that there was nothing really binding the colonies to England anymore, and that therefore revolution was not just necessary, but that it was possible that the colonies could actually win a revolutionary war, which is something almost nobody else would have imagined at the time. So Charles Carroll of Carrollton is a lot of things, but one of them, I think, is he's a visionary. And he is a guy who kind of charts the course intellectually for what follows, which is, as we know, the American Revolution and the successful American Revolution.
Yeah, so I guess you're talking about dissolving bonds like the Declaration of Independence says that these Catholics in Maryland, you know, precisely because of this religious hostility, but they've been able to experience at least some toleration in the Maryland colony. You know, they really have more of a sense of, you know, we should just go our own way. We should break our, you know, take our own path. We need independence. But it's also interesting with Carroll, this brings up another issue that you note that Charles Carroll was perhaps maybe the richest man in the colonies at the time and also expended much of his finances on the American Revolution. But with that wealth also came for many people of his time and in Maryland, like other southern colonies, was a slaveholding colony. He was then a slave owner. So you have this issue of many Catholics in Maryland owning slaves. And you begin the book precisely with the 1739 slave revolt, a slave revolt of Stono River in South Carolina, where slaves there tried to escape from South Carolina and go to Spanish-ruled Florida, which had abolished slavery. And the ruling Spaniards there said that, you know, any slave who can escape here, they'll get their freedom. And you indicate that there's perhaps a large role of the Catholic faith in the 1739 slave revolt, because many of the slaves came from the Congo from a conquered Catholic kingdom. Discuss the role of the Catholic Church and slavery in colonial America and the Revolution.
Well, as you say, there are a lot of Catholics. There are individual Catholics like Charles Carroll of Carrollton, and there are institutional Catholics like the Jesuits who are slaveholders during this time. And something that I think does need to be pointed out is this is something that contravened the magisterium of the church. The Catholic Church had said in the 15th century that slavery is no go. And everyone who is a Catholic slaveholder, whether they be a personal Catholic slaveholder or an institutional one, they're going against the magisterium of their own church. Now, we can certainly say that there are a lot of ways that those Catholics and Catholics today go against the teachings of the church. But I do think it's important that, you know, we can't let them off the hook. The flip side of not letting him off the hook, and when I say not letting him off the hook, I mean Charles Carroll's a very wealthy man. Could he have freed his slaves? I try to get at that a little bit in the notes section of the book. It's a complicated question, but I do think it has to be asked. Is it possible? You know, I think it's possible, and we got to ask that question, but I think the other side of the role of Catholicism and slavery in the American Revolution is we got to remember, I think, to look at it from the perspective of the time and not just from our current perspective. It doesn't mean that we throw all our standards out or excuse things that should not be excused, but I also think, you know, that the popular thing that happens in a lot of places, and you know, you see it not just in American revolutionary history, but in all kinds of history. You know, we judge yesterday by today's standards, and sometimes we judge today by tomorrow's standards. And when that happens, pretty much everybody pulls up short. This is one reason why those revolutions we talked about earlier, like the French Revolution, it's one reason they devour their own so quickly, because you can never be revolutionary enough. Today's Robespierre is tomorrow's, his head didn't end up in a basket, but pretty much everybody else who was a leader, they all kind of suffered that same fate. So we got to be careful, I think, in how we judge this man. I think the line in Liberty's Lines is, does the fact that Catholics were slaveholders mean that they weren't great men? No, I don't think it means that. I think it means they weren't as great as they could have and should have been, especially had they followed the dictates of their own church. So the history between Catholicism and slavery, it's conjoined, it's difficult. There aren't any easy answers to any of this stuff. The best thing we can do is not sweep any of it under the rug, ask the tough questions, but also remember how we ought to view this period of history, just like we view any period of history. Well, we don't view it by today's standards because it's not the same. It's not the same country that we live in.
Well, I find interesting as well, in conjunction with slavery, that you talk about how the Marquis de Lafayette, he wanted to buy a plant. He bought a plantation in French Guiana, I believe it was, Suriname, because he wanted to free the slaves there, as well as Kosciuszko. For his part, he wanted to, in his will, or he wanted to give money to free slaves in America as well. So there you have the other side of the ledger, that individuals here in this revolutionary epoch who fought for America are looking to abolish slavery. So that's an interesting contrast.
That's true, and certainly the two guys that you mentioned, in fact, the plantation in Guyana, that really ends up being the Marquis de Lafayette's wife who is instrumental in running it and enacting this idea that he had. And most people admitted, and she was a much better administrator of these sorts of affairs than he was. He had the idea. She's the person who really ended up doing the grunt work to carry it out. Kosciuszko is an ardent abolitionist, and as you mentioned, he wants Jefferson to free his slaves using the money that Kosciuszko has earned during the American Revolution, and he wants it because he can't figure out how the guy who wrote these words that he has read in the Declaration of Independence, he can't figure out how that guy can also be a slaveholder. And unfortunately for Kosciuszko, his wishes don't end up being fulfilled. It's probably a good thing for him that he didn't live to see how Jefferson carried them out, or maybe I should say didn't carry them out. But you're absolutely right. There are examples of people who were slaveholders. But then on the other side of the ledger, there are people who are very, very passionate in their belief that slavery is a moral evil, and they don't just talk the talk, they actually put their own money where the mouths are to try to free these slaves and really live up to the ideals of the Catholic Church.
Well, I guess in closing out here, you talk about George Washington as sort of the greatest Catholic who never was. There had been some speculation, you know, about maybe George Washington had become Catholic. But I think you make the interesting example that, you know, George Washington, it's, all evidence seems to indicate that he probably was indeed a Christian and not just a deist. But he certainly believed in the idea of religion in general, of a moral faith, and therefore encouraging religion as a necessary support of morality in any free society, that a republic needs that religious virtue in order to survive, something outside of itself. And that, again, as you know, is a key difference between the American and French revolutions. And so George Washington really encouraged this sort of general religious belief, this latitudinarianism, as we would call them. You know, for example, that he ended these sort of bigoted festivities of the Pope's Night, the American version of the Guy Fawkes Day in England, of burning the Pope in effigy among the soldiers of the Continental Army. So I think that's an inspiring example of how all Americans, they need to consider the role of a faith in a moral monotheism, a good God, as the Declaration of Independence indicates, that our rights come from our Creator. He's endowed a man with these inalienable rights. So that's a very inspiring example for Independence Day.
You know, I think it sounds crazy to say that George Washington, for all that we know about him, for all that he has been lionized, it sounds crazy to say that he's still underrated. And yet, in a lot of ways, I think that's true. And the point that you just mentioned about Washington's view of religion as it pertained to government is an idea that I'm not sure that a lot of people associate with him. And yet, it's this view, this Washingtonian view, that religion and morals are kind of the underpinning of any successful government, and therefore government has obligation to recognize them when they are furthering the ends of governance. It's that view that I think a lot of Americans understand instinctively, as opposed to the Jeffersonian view or the Madisonian view, which are much more secular, much more in line with the French Revolution than the American one. Washington's view, I think, is the common sense view of things. We have moved away from it in a lot of ways, and we've moved away from it, I think, at great cost in a lot of cases. But yet, if you put these views in front of most Americans, I think they would recognize that Washington's view is it's the one that makes government work the way that we're used to it working, when it works.
Well, excellent. This is a very interesting book, excellent read, even for people who know a lot about the American Revolution. I recommend people get a copy. Where can our listeners get a copy, Dan?
They can get it from the publisher, Sophia Institute. That's sophiainstitute.com. If you would like a signed copy, you can go to my website, which is Dan Leroy, that's LEROY.com. I'll be glad to sign one up any way you like and ship it out to you. You can also read more about some of my other books and upcoming speaking engagements and the rest. So either of those places, as well as all the normal online retailers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the rest.
All right, excellent. Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to look at important current events for conservatives and others. And we've been discussing with Dan Leroy, the recent author of Liberty's Lions, the Catholic Revolutionaries Who Made America. Dan Leroy, thank you for joining the show.
Andrew, thanks so much for the great questions and the opportunity to talk about this book, and happy 4th of July weekend to you and all your listeners.
All right, well, happy 4th all, and we'll tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.